We wouldn't be able to keep this archive going without your support. Donate online today at wyxr.org.
Tuesday, I am fading into your arms so I can
WYXR Memphis.
Choices is celebrating 50 years of reproductive health at their 50th anniversary gala on October 26th at the Kent. Get ready for a groovy night with a 70s disco glam theme, taking us back to their founding days in 1974. The evening doesn't end there. The after party features DJ Bizzle Blue Bland, go-go dancers, and free drinks and food. Tickets are available for both the gala and the after party. More information and tickets can be found at choicesgala.org. That's choicesgala.org.
To WYXR 91.7 FM Memphis.
And you're now listening to WYXR 91.7 FM, Memphis's U of M Hour. We're doing a quick break before we get into this lovely interview.
Happy Pledge Drive.
Happy Pledge Drive.
You loved what you just heard on Light Rotation Radio and it cured all of your, if you're grieving AOL and MySpace and LimeWire, make a donation now, WYXR.org. Stoked for this interview, though.
Yeah, it's an interview with Sarah Brown interviews Sid Bolens, who worked with like Bob Dylan and all sorts of stuff and has a memoir out.
That's really great.
And
this also just highlights the really great partnership we have between the University of Memphis and WYXR. And if you want to keep supporting that for years to come, you can donate WYXR.org.
Let's get into it, I guess.
Let's get it.
Hi, everyone. I'm Sarah Brown, professor of performance at the University of Memphis Department of Theater and Dance, and I want the Memphis community to know about an extraordinary and free event that's happening at First Congregational Church, also known as First Congo, on October 18th at 7:30 in the evening. First Congo is located at 1000 South Cooper Street. This event will feature a remarkable guest artist named Sidney Bolens. Sid is a two-time Grammy Award nominee, musician, singer, songwriter, stage actor, and author. With an extraordinary career spanning 50 years in the music industry, Sid Bolens has gone from singing backup with rock and roll legends such as Elton John, Bob Dylan, and Rod Stewart, to singing lead vocals on the Grease movie soundtrack, to having his own 9 critically acclaimed solo albums, featuring appearances by Bonnie Raitt, Bryan Adams, Emmylou Harris, and so many others. Sid's triumphs have also been counterbalanced by personal loss and struggle. Since he was born and for most of Sid's life, up until around 14 years ago, Sidney was known as Cindy. And Cindy knew from the age of 4 that he was born in the wrong body. Finally, in 2011, Cindy changed his name to Sydney. And in 2012, he came out as transgender, not knowing what the personal or professional response would be. Sid Bullins wrote and performed a successful solo show about his life called Somewhere Between, Not an Ordinary Life. And he has also written a stunning memoir about his remarkable journey called Trans Electric, My Life as a Cosmic Rockstar. And he's sitting here with me right now to talk about it. Sydney Bullins, thank you for being here and talking with me.
Thank you for having me. Good to be here.
As a teacher of many ambitious young people who dream of fame, I'm always telling them that talent is not quite as important as chutzpah. And I know that chutzpah plays a large role in how you advanced your career at a young age when you first went to LA, and I'd love you to talk about that.
Yes, I had a lot more chutzpah then than I do now. So if you're young, you know, flaunt it. But yes, I went to Los Angeles after I grew up in Massachusetts. After high school, I went to a couple of years of acting school in New York City.
Yes, the American Academy of Dramatic Arts.
I graduated there. And then I went to Los Angeles to find my fame and fortune. And I nearly did. And did to some extent. But anyway, without going into the whole long story, it's all in my memoir, Trans Electric. But one of the examples of chutzpah for me was about a year, not even a year after I arrived in Los Angeles. And there was a lot that happened within that year.
Right.
Before this happened. But I crashed a party where I knew Elton John was going to be. And it was in a recording studio in Hollywood. And I knew the owners of the recording studio because I used to hang out there and I would get coffee for the people who were recording there and run errands. And occasionally they'd drag me in to do a gang backup vocal or something for someone. And I met a lot of people there and it was a wonderful hang, obviously.
Right.
And so I knew that this particular night, Elton John was going to be in this studio where they were hosting a press party for a 60s star who was making a comeback in the mid-70s, Neil Sedaka. He had a lot of hits in the 60s and was trying to make a comeback in the mid-70s. And he had just signed with Rocket Records, which Elton John's label back then, and still is, I believe. And so anyway, they took the big studio and they set it up with, you know, hors d'oeuvres and drinks and all that stuff. And all the people were gathered there.
You were 25, 24?
So I was 25, yes. Okay. And so we were in the control room looking into the fishbowl of this press party in the studio part. And I just had this instinct or inkling or, you know, desire even to go into the studio. And interestingly enough, it wasn't like I thought, oh, I'm going to meet Elton John. I just thought I needed to go in there. So I announced to my friends, the owners, that I was going into the party. And they said, no, you can't go in. And I said, yes, I can. And I did. And after a few minutes I went right to the food, of course, and got myself a little plate and, you know, something. And I just stood there. And of course, I was young and I had a certain look, which I describe in the book. I was a female and I was an androgynous female, meaning that nobody ever in my life could tell whether I was a boy or a girl or a man or a woman.
And in the music industry at that time, maybe that fared well.
It fared well for men. It didn't fare so well for women. And that's another subject. But I had a look. It fared well for me in some cases. And before I knew it, out of the corner of my eye, I saw Elton walking toward me. And of course, my first naive thought was he's going to kick me out. And of course, if anybody was going to kick me out, it wasn't going to be Elton, right? Somebody else was going to do his dirty work.
Right.
So he was walking toward me and I thought, uh-oh. And he came up to me and he introduced himself to me, just very kindly and sincerely. Incredible. I told him who I was and we started talking. And the short story is that that was a Wednesday night. And 2 days later, I was on the road with him. So it's just was a crazy. I got hired that night to sing backup vocals for Elton John on the Rock of the Westies tour. I found out a lot later. I found out that they had fired somebody to hire me. We've remained friends. The best part of that whole story, that was in September of 1975. It's October of 2024, and we're still friends.
That's so amazing.
He did the introduction to my memoir.
Well, yes, he did. He did the foreward, and you have incredible
forward. Yes, the forward.
He have incredible endorsements on that book from Broadway producers and directors to music industry luminaries and Carl Bernstein, which is sort of off the wall.
Bernstein and Billie Jean King. You know, for those older folks who are listening.
Yes, I think what's so interesting about here, you are 25. Within a couple of weeks. If I'm exaggerating, you know, let me, but within a couple of weeks of you meeting Elton and getting that opportunity, you're on a private plane going to, you know.
Within a week.
You had a week.
You're not exaggerating, okay. Within a week.
Okay, yeah. Okay. And you're 25 years old on this private plane.
And I had done virtually nothing before that. I worked with Bob Crew, the producer, and who wrote The Four Seasons and so on. And that's another story of how I met him, because I was homeless for a while, wandering the streets of Los Angeles, and met him and got into the studio, which led me to meeting the studio people. My life was just crazy back then.
No, it's incredible. And just prior to when you got that offer from Elton John through his assistant, you also suddenly were poised with two decisions you had to make, whether to go on a tour with Bob Dylan.
Right.
I mean, you know, they say when it rains, it pours. All of a sudden, this kid who'd come to LA with $100, who had dreams in his head, all of a sudden, what was that like?
Yeah, so there is a back story. Before I met Elton, I met Bob Dylan. And, through another friend who I'd met through Bob Crew, who I just mentioned.
Yes.
And I went to New York to be a part of what was the beginning of the now iconic Rolling Thunder review that Bob Dylan did back in 1975. And I was asked to go, I was part of the Rolling Thunder review. So I was slated already when I met Elton to go on the road with Bob Dylan, start in October of 75. So when I met Elton on that Wednesday night, I had Thursday to decide whether I was going on the road with Elton or Bob Dylan. Because Friday, I was starting rehearsals with Elton. And so this is 3 day, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday. So in one day I had to decide, as someone who had done nothing really except sing backups on a couple of albums and songs, deciding to go with one or the other iconic figure in American and musical culture.
God.
And I write about this in the book too. It wasn't an easy decision, but Elton, because with Bob Dylan, I would have been doing, not singing backup. I mean, I might have been, but I was singing my own songs and playing guitar as backup. I was part of his band.
Wow.
But I would have had one or two of my own songs within that. So I would have been a featured artist along with a lot of other people. I mean, there were a lot of other people, but including Joni Mitchell and Joan Baez and Mick Ronson. I mean, there was a lot of named people, and I would have been one of the people. But with Elton, even though I was a backup singer, hired as a backup singer, there was nobody bigger than Elton John in 1975. Nobody. Not Frank Sinatra, not, and these are names that some people might know or not know, who are young. There was no one bigger. Bob Dylan was not bigger than Elton John at that time in 1975. In fact, the Rolling Thunder Review was, they thought it would be a good way for him to get back in the limelight, so to speak. He never lost his talent, Dylan, but it was just the changing of the times and the changing of the musical culture and so on. And Elton was, there was nobody bigger. I mean, no one bigger in the world than Elton John. And I was a rock and roller. I was, I mean, when you say I was, since I was 4 years old, I knew I was a boy in a girl's body. I also knew that I was going to, wanted to be a rock and roll star from 4 years old.
Okay. So, okay. That's incredible.
So, it was just, I could not pass up doing a stadium tour of 60 to 80,000 people singing backup with an, with Elton John. And it was, just, I mean, that's, I, you know, I write a lot about it. And the first third of my book is about my rock and roll. The book is kind of in three or four different parts, but three real parts, you know, my rock and roll, what I call the bells and whistles, which is my rock and roll stuff with all the name dropping.
Right.
Because other stuff happened. And then the second part is about my family life. And the third part is about my transition and my
I wanted to say about this dream of rock and roll and being a rock and roll. Often you know, I tell this to my students who want to be actors and want to be famous. They go out into the world and they have certain ideas and certain, and their life doesn't necessarily go the way they're imagining. And they, not only is the new road they found a more authentic road for them, but it's one that surprises them and that, you know, it ends up nurturing them more. I'm saying this because in 1971, you were invited by Bobby Newirth, who's the great record producer, singer, songwriter, to come to New York.
That was 75.
75? Okay.
Yeah. In 1975. No, I didn't know him. In 71, I was in acting school in New York.
Okay. Yeah. Okay. In 1975.
That's how I met Dylan. Yeah.
Right. All right. And you were invited to come to the other end in Greenwich Village, the very prestigious, wonderful, hip music venue. And
well, the Bitter End. It was only the other end for a short amount of time. It's the iconic Bitter End. It was before and it is now.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. When was it called the other end?
Just in 75 and 76. I think it was only for a couple of years. And there is a reason why they changed the name. But it's the Bitter End for any people who are studying folk music
in
New York City, in Greenwich Village.
Yeah, you said that playing, the opportunity to play with these venerable lineup of musicians.
Yeah.
You said these you were excited about it because these musicians spoke my musical language. What did you mean by that? And how is that different than your dream of rock and roll and what you were doing before?
Well, it wasn't different. And so the conflation here is that, but the reason I was going, had to decide between Bob Dylan and Elton John was that time. I went to the other end, and that was in New York to be a part of what became the Rolling Thunder Review. So it was all happening at the same time. But the people, so those musicians who sang with Bob Dylan and who ended up going on the road with him were authentic. So you have to get the context of what I was saying that with. So before all of that, I was working with Bob Crewe, who was a commercial pop producer. He produced the Four Seasons. He produced, you know, a ton of 60s hits. Mm-hmm. But it was pop music, and commercial. And back in those days, commercial was kind of a dirty word. Nowadays, it isn't. But back then, so I felt, I mean, obviously, Elton John was commercial, but it was also, they were also songs where the lyrics were written by Bernie Taupin. They touched some kind of emotional, they elicited an emotional response. And I think to me, We could have a whole, I mean, I could have a whole discussion in the music department or the acting department or whatever about authenticity and my feelings about the effects of music and even in acting. I mean, there are actors who act and there are actors who, and I'm not talking about method acting, I'm talking about, you know, actors who try to find the emotional hook within themselves that they can create that character out of, right, that they're playing. Mm-hmm. And so it becomes more of an authentic, even though they're acting and speaking words that aren't their own, they're acting from a place inside them rather than just repeating the words in a way that they think the character might do.
Right, right.
And so to me, I've always been about, or tried to be, I should say, maybe I failed at some points in my life, and I have, but tried to be authentic. Well, actually, I'll take that back. There was a time in my music career where I tried to be somebody other than who I was, and it comes out in some of my songs. But that said, my basic tendency was to try to be authentic. So though when I know this is a long-winded answer. Right. So in the context of your question, I was coming from working with Bob Crewe, who was doing disco music, and I was writing disco songs because yes, it had just come out, which I didn't care for. I didn't like. They meant nothing to me.
Right.
So having the opportunity to play with Bob Dylan and those people who were surrounding him was much more in tune with what I wanted to do, even though I didn't consider myself ever a folk singer. I always thought of myself as somebody who wanted to do rock and roll. And even if you want to go back to my generation of the Beatles and the Rolling Stones, even though the Beatles are considered pop music, they were inventing certain aspects. They were changing the culture with their music. So whether or not they were profound lyrics doesn't really matter here. They were affecting the culture in a way that changed the world.
Right.
And that they did. They not only changed music, they changed pop music, they changed the world through their music. They changed not only the musical world, but they literally changed culture. The Beatles.
Yes. Yes, that's right. That's right.
So it changed the world. So I didn't think I was going to change the world, but I just wanted to be involved in people who were not just doing something that was going to make money, or which I'm still grappling with today. You know, I wanted to be with authentic people. And I guess that's the way. That's the short. I wanted to be with authentic people. I wanted to write songs that affected you somehow.
Right.
Somehow, in a way that was a little bit deeper than just liking the song, you know? And I think that goes for acting too. And by the way, back to your point about your young people who go and think they're going to do something and something happens and they don't do it. I went to acting school. And the first time I acted in a legitimate play was 2 months ago.
I know. We can talk about it.
So music happened because I didn't, you know, I wanted both, but music happened and I never did go into acting until just recently. So anything can happen if you stay alive long enough.
All right. We're taking a quick little break in this interview. Part two is coming up next.
Yes. You're listening to WYXR 91.7 FM Memphis, and it is our fall pledge drive. So you can head to WYXR.org right now, make a contribution. We would love your support to make stories like these keep happening on air.
Oh, yeah. It's a pretty fun. It was a pretty fun conversation.
Yes.
We are at 39% of the goal, and we are looking to try and make it 100.
But I think in the next hour we can kick it up to 40. But it takes you to make that happen. So do it. WYXR.org. Make a contribution right now. Support listener supported, volunteer driven radio.
Do it.
Or you can call us 901-460-3031.
All right. Don't change that dial. Keep it locked at WYXR.
It is incredible to have started off your career as an actor and then hanging your hat on music and that taking you so far and then ending up on back on stage in a musical.
Yeah.
So that's amazing. I wanted to talk about when I met you in that coffee shop, Starbucks, off of I-40, I had told you at the end of our conversation that there's something magical about you. I really think, and this is, I got the sense of this in reading the things that happened to you, that whatever fueled your chutzpah, which is something in you that is fearless, that believes in yourself, I think that's what prompts chutzpah, is that there's something we feel about ourselves. There's a confidence. And you exhibited that confidence, and I'm getting to a point here. You exhibited that confidence also, that chutzpah, when you went to, you were told to go to a dinner party, a friend told you to go to a dinner party, bring your, a track, a demo tape, and to not, and you knew that Bob Crewe was going to be at the dinner party, and you were told to just knock at the back door and give your demo tape to whoever answers that door and make sure that they give it to him and leave. You were sworn not to go into the party, and you end up going, knocking on the door, and who answers the back door? But I recall that it was Bob Crewe. Am I wrong?
Yeah.
And he invites you in, asks the hostess to pull up a chair for you, and you ended up being the star of the party. You were playing your songs. Everybody in the was giving you their cards.
Yeah.
And I just think that's the funniest, most magical story, that you unwittingly you took over that party. That wasn't your intent. You really.
No, it wasn't my intent at all. And it turned out that, and Bob Crewe pulled me in, and that was the beginning of all the things we've already talked about.
Right.
Meeting Bob Crewe that night was the foundation of all the other magical things happening. That was in 1973. And
but there was something about you sitting there, coming in there. You hadn't even played yet. All he had was this object of a tape in his hand, but there was something compelling about you. And yes, you can say it was your look and it was this, and it was that, but there's something else going on that I think is just a deep belief in oneself. And I see your life peppered with these moments, these little floods of miracles or where people are drawn to you and giving you opportunities, opening certain doors for you. And I'm amazed that at the same time in your young life, experiencing this thing that had to evince from a confidence, you were also experiencing a discomfort in your gender identity, in your body.
Mm-hmm.
And I wonder if you wonder this, how might it have been even different if you hadn't had that? Was that part of the magic for you, the discomfort? Was that it? How would you
I think my androgyny was, and that may go to my look, but it also may go to, it's hard for me to talk about myself this way, but I do say it in the book. This, I think some people have chi or charisma and some people don't. And I only say this from in my old age, looking back. You know, I wrote the book and, you know, people would say, oh, it's a cathartic to write a memoir if you're writing the truth, you know, and it really was. And it wasn't, or if it wasn't cathartic, it was at least revelatory, because I did keep journals for 50 years and I did have to go back and read them all, which is a blessing and a curse. Believe me, I write about it in the epilogue, how reading my journals during the pandemic, I wrote the book during the pandemic, was part of the reason why I went into a terrible depression, but because I was looking at not just those magical moments, but also the painful moments of who I was and the choices I made and, you know, all this, my drug addiction back then.
Yes.
And, you know, just all the stuff. But anyway, I did in my youth have what you call a belief in myself. I really knew, I think, there was something in me that knew that I had something to give, first of all, but something different from most people. And maybe, I think, feeling, you know, this is tough, but I had a fierceness in me, partly because I couldn't be who I wanted to be. I wasn't what I thought I was. In other words, I really did know that my mother used to say I was born wrong, and right. I was a boy. I just was. I had female parts, but I was a boy. There wasn't a shred of femaleness in me, and still isn't. Never right. was and never will be. And I know there's a spectrum of gender, and I'm flat on one side of it as a trans person, you know? Right. And in fact, young people who I talk to, I was shocked when I found out that there was something called gender fluid or non-binary, you know? I don't relate to that, you know? I am really on the far side of the trans spectrum. But all of that coming back to your question, I think there was something in me that was emoting some kind of difference. You know, I wasn't a typical girl and I wasn't a boy.
Right.
And I don't mean to use typical in a demeaning way.
No.
You know, I just wasn't, there was something different about me. And don't forget, this is the mid 70s. So, or the early 70s, the mid 70s. You know, in the later 70s even, and even into the 80s, there wasn't this whole thing about gender. You know, now, I mean, I have grandchildren who are 17 and 15, and I have grandchildren who are 9 and 6 too, but the 17-year-old, wow. 15-year-old girls, and then the boys who are the younger ones, they don't care. They don't look at a person. In fact, they meet you, what pronouns are you do you use? You know, they don't have this. So if someone is non-binary in their school or in their lives, it's not the same effect. And I'm talking about when one of them meets each other, when a 15-year-old meets a 15-year-old non-binary person, it's not a strange phenomenon for them.
Right.
Back in my day, it wasn't, for a female, it wasn't a common thing. For males, with Mick Jagger and David Bowie and, you know, other people, it was more common to be called androgynous. For females to be on the male side, it wasn't as common. So there were a lot of factors. Obviously, I'm talking about myself, and I don't know what other people see in me. I can't tell you exactly what it was. All I know is that some of those, if not all of those instances where the magic happened for me, where those magical moments that just fell into my lap, they wouldn't have happened if I didn't look the way I looked. I'm talking about being the mixture of male and female.
Yeah.
I know they wouldn't. That I know.
Yeah.
And they probably wouldn't have happened if I was a male.
Interesting. See, that's very interesting to me. And, you know, it's funny that you speak about going to the New York Public Library while you were in New York, 1971. There's where the 1971 is.
That's right.
You went, you know, because that was the research. We didn't have Google.
Right. We didn't have the internet. We didn't have computers.
So you went to the New York Public Library to see if there was a book on gender identity or gender studies.
I was so, you know, I had lots of friends. I was very, very, I've been very fortunate in my life that, I mean, I'm a loner in the fact that I love spending time alone without people. And but I've also been blessed with a lot of friends in my life. And I knew, and I had friends in acting school, a lot of friends, you know, hanging out together and doing stuff. But I always felt different. I always felt like, what is wrong with me? I mean, I, you know, was attracted to girls. I had a girlfriend in high school, you know, and but I was also attracted to men too, in a different way. But I didn't, and I talk about this, and I will probably say something about this when I do my event, because I'm going to read from my book and I'm going to play some songs. And
just for our listeners, just for our listeners, I'm here with Sydney Bullins, and we're talking about his extraordinary life that he's written about in a stunning memoir called Trans Electric, My Life as a Cosmic Rockstar, which will be the centerpiece or subject of his concert memoir reading at First Congo Church, First Congregational Church on October 18th at 7:30 p.m. He's going to sing his songs, and he's going to talk about his life and read from his memoir. It's free and open to the public.
With a Q&A too.
With a Q&A and a reception afterwards and a book signing. So we could get up close and personal with him, and it should be a very rich and wonderful evening. Again, it's gonna be at First Congregational Church, which is at 1000 South Cooper Street. Many people lovingly call it First Congo. And the event is on October 18th at 7:30 p.m. You know, so we're talking about, I just have two more questions. I know we're running out of time here.
That's okay, go ahead.
You talk about very much that when you were young, feeling that you could feel your breasts coming in, and you thought to yourself, oh, I'm gonna have to spend the rest of my life pretending I'm a girl, something like, some kind of thought like that came into your head. Mm-hmm. And yet, after you, when you had your two girls, you had two children, two girls, Jesse and Reed, and you express a kind of satisfaction or a feeling of just a sort of magic in breastfeeding and in and in the function of a woman's body at that time. So how you went from wanting top, you know, not wanting top surgery, but imagining your body as a boy's, and yet enjoying this side of it.
So after I left rock and roll, I got married to a gay man who was my one of my best friends, and we decided to get married, and we really tried to fit a square peg into a round hole. We moved from Los Angeles to Westport, well, to Connecticut, and then ended up in Westport, Connecticut, which is, people don't know, is like the Tony, they used to call the word Tony Town, you know, with, you know, just celebrities live there, and it's a very upper class New England town. It's a great town, but totally different from what I had been living in Los Angeles as a rock and roller. But I got married, and Dan did too, my ex-husband, and we decided to have children, and we had one daughter, Reed, and then we had another, Jesse. And what I'm talking about is the only experience I have experienced in my female body where I celebrate and am grateful for, not only celebrate, but I'm grateful for, is that I was pregnant and bore two babies. And that experience to me was spiritual. It was otherworldly. It was an amazing thing. And I am still, even though I am a male now, and that was in my early 30s, and I still am a mother. My daughter Jessie died at 11 years old of complications from cancer. But my daughter Reed has the four children, and I'm still a mother. She still calls me mom. She said to me when I first started transitioning, "What should I call you?" And I said, "You got to call me mom because that's who I am, and never be your father." She has a father. She calls me Sid if we're on a plane or, you know, somewhere where it could be dangerous.
Right,
but,
right.
But I'm her mother, and I was Jesse's mother. And when I was pregnant, I wanted, if I was going to experience this thing as someone who felt like a man, if I was going to be pregnant, and this is the way of my life, this may be that thing you were talking about at the beginning. If I'm going to experience something, I want to experience the whole thing. I want the whole ball of wax. I don't want to skim around anything. If it's going to be an experience, man, I want to be there.
Right.
And experience it to the fullest.
You're going to go, you're not going to wait outside the glass window. You're going to go into the party.
That's right. And you know, and that's been my life. My life has been, there is no middle ground in my life. And that is what you'll read in my book. That's what you'll hear from me. That's what my songs are about. There is no middle ground. It's either way up there or way down there. It's there's nothing static about my life. That's why I named my one-person show Somewhere Between Not an Ordinary Life, because it isn't.
And right,
still, it's apparently it's still going on that way. But anyway, I wanted to experience the whole thing, and therefore I had two natural childbirths, and I wanted to breastfeed, and I did. And it was a profound and sublime experience to bond with my children the way I did. And now, when I was 9 months pregnant and looking at my body, I would laugh. I would just laugh because I still felt like a guy, you know, inside.
Right.
But I was pregnant, nine months pregnant, and I was huge. And I would just laugh. But I loved being a mother. I loved being a mother. And it makes me cry, you know, because it was such a profound experience. And you know, I won't talk about losing Jesse now because there's not enough time, but that's the other end of birth, is
yes,
losing a young child.
Mm-hmm.
And the miracle of birth to, in my life, to the death of a child, my child, is about, there's nothing further apart than those two experiences. And so I've lived the gamut of life. And I mean, I hope I've got more life ahead of me. But even as we spoke about we spoke about Albert Cashier a little bit, and it was a true story. And just that fell out of nowhere to me. Doing that part was a highlight of my life. And here I am at my age now, getting a new experience of doing what I originally wanted to do, which was act.
Right.
And so, you know, for the young people out there, you know, it is about showing up. It's just about showing up. And there's been plenty of times in my life when I haven't wanted to show up. And those are the times when I make the mistakes,
right,
you know, in my life. But it's like, you know, it's just showing up and being authentic. And I think I had to transition when I did at 60 years old, you know, and because I couldn't live the rest of my life without being, once I found out that it was possible, I mean, really possible,
right,
not at 19 when I thought about doing it after going to the public library and finding out what I was, but because I couldn't have done it then. But when I finally realized I could do it, it was late in my life, but I did it. And the gifts that I've gotten from doing it, from transitioning, have been profound. I've also lost people in my life, you know, and of course with the political issues around being transgender and the vilification of us, It's terrible. It's a terrible thing, but we're not going away. You know, right. We're not going away. None of us who are deemed the other, whether it's culturally or ethnically or LGBTQ, whatever it is, we're not going away. And that's why I think it's important for me to be out there, for my story to be out there. Hopefully it'll affect people in a positive way.
Will, and I know we're going to wrap up now, but I will say that I am looking forward also to hearing, as you say, the other end of this with about Jesse and about personal loss and loss of your child. I think the Memphis community and students who come and artists will gain a lot from hearing how you navigated such a loss, because we can either implode, get stagnant, or we can go deeper into life and pull out something that kind of helps us.
I would like to invite bereaved parents who would like to come, and or anybody out there. I mean, my story is wide ranging. I touch on a lot of different subjects, and I sing pretty good too. So
I first knew about you because I watched a video of you singing, and I wept. You are so soulful. Your music is so beautiful, and. It's no wonder that you have 9 critically acclaimed solo albums and that so many people agree to sing on your records and your songs. And so we're looking forward to hearing that. And I just want to tell our listeners, I feel so privileged to have been sitting here with you for this hour. This is Sidney Bullins I've been talking to, and we've been talking about his incredible life and his stunning memoir called Transelectric, My Life as a Cosmic Rockstar. And this will be the centerpiece of his concert memoir reading later this month, October 18th, at First Congregational Church, also known as First Congo, October 18th at 7:30 p.m. It's free and open to the public, and he'll be singing his songs and reading from his memoir. There'll be a Q&A, a reception with cookies. Who doesn't like cookies? And a book signing as well. I think that it's going to be a real treat for whoever comes, and I'm really looking forward to this.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to it too. I love Memphis. I've played there before. I've been there many, many times, and I hope you all come out and say hello to me. I'd love to meet you.
Sidney Bullins, thank you so much.
Thank you. I really appreciate it.
It's WYXR 91.7 FM, Memphis, Tennessee. WYXR.org.
And it's our pledge drive.
Yes, it's our fall pledge drive, Saturday to Saturday. If you enjoyed what you just heard, thanks to the U of M Hour, show them some love at WYXR.org.
Yeah, it's like one of the really cool things with WYXR is the fact that we have this partnership with the University of Memphis. So it gives, you know, the younger people the voice.
We have great interns and, all year long, paid interns, might I add. And we have meeting in the middle every year with the University of Memphis. We just really love keeping that partnership strong, and it takes you to keep it going. We are listener supported, volunteer driven. So show some love.
Yep.
Some monetary love.
Yep. At WYXR.org.
Yes.
Yeah.
Or you can give us a call, 901-460-3031. But WYXR is the quickest, securest way to do it. All right. We'll listen to some music for a bit. So stay tuned in. WYXR.org. head to WYXR.org right now. Make your contribution. Support the station with the city's soul. It's our fall pledge drive. We'd love to show you some love right back, right here on air. WYXR.org.